There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
You're listening to Drive Live, and it's the time of the week that we get our free legal advice.
Drive Live talks legal.
We have a guest in the studio today. It's the lovely Ludmila Yamalova from Yamalova and Plethka. Good afternoon, Ludmila.
Good afternoon. Good to be here. And thanks for the compliments, as always.
Lovely to have you on the show, Ludmila. And we've already got questions in for you, which is no surprise. But if you do want to ask Ludmila a question, the best place to get her, 4001, via the DubaiEye Messenger app, if you want to use that for free. Or we have a new number, 0487155000. The beauty of using the number is sometimes we get texts in, Ludmila, don't we? And we need a little bit more clarification or detail. At least if you're on the phone, we can get that to you and we can answer your question perfectly. We're going to start with a topic, though, Ludmila. And this is a topic that's close to my heart and I'm sure many other people, is when your phone goes. And sometimes I find I'm in the middle of doing something else. I'm maybe making dinner or I'm busy and I answer the phone thinking, oh, you know, it might be something to do with work. And it's an unsolicited call. And sometimes they are nuisance calls. They may be thought to be from an agency. They maybe say that you've won something. But it's quite difficult when you receive these unsolicited calls, first of all, to work out if it's genuine. And second of all, it's quite annoying.
Well, indeed. And with regards to unsolicited calls, there are different regulations that apply to different professionals. So, for example, with regards to unsolicited calls from brokers, the Land Department has come on record a few times already, making it very clear that it's actually illegal for brokers to make these unsolicited calls, and that recipients of such calls could actually report them and the brokers would be fined. Now, that's as far as brokers are concerned, and obviously that to and of itself takes effort and resources to actually carry through with reporting brokers, and yeah, probably a few people actually want to make take the time to do it. But at least in that particular case, that industry or that profession is somewhat regulated. But what if you receive calls, and which makes it a lot more difficult, calls from, for example, somebody who claims to be part of some kind of a governmental or a semi-governmental agency, and this is what we are seeing a lot more of recently, and it comes, it's actually sort of fairly cyclical. Sometimes we have more of these, requests from our clients or questions from our clients than other times. But when calls come in from someone who claims to work, for example, for a government authority, but they do this in the context of, let's say, selling some ad space. Or some kind of a charity or donation, and so it's very different when you're talking to someone who represents to be from an official, and obviously we take those kind of calls a lot differently than if we get a call from an agent, whom we can just say, well, we have nothing, please take my number off your list and call me again. So we've had a few clients who have had these kind of requests recently, and obviously people want to be polite and civil, especially because it could potentially be an official call, and so. So I will tell you, so a few times what has happened and what we recommend you do is that anytime anybody is asking you ultimately for money, be it by virtue of selling ad space or by some kind of contribution or charity or sponsorship and things of that nature, they should to do it right, to do it legally, because that particular industry is also quite heavily regulated. It has to be done formally. Now, to do it formally, you don't do it through a phone call. Just request that person to follow up in their official capacity and state their request, and obviously state who they are officially. Every time this we've done, even or our clients have done this, on our advice, it works. And generally speaking, if you think about it logically, if somebody represents to be part of the government or some sort of a government agency and they're asking for money, it's a very logical thing to ask, and it's a logical thing to receive some formal confirmation by email, for example, that says, yes, we're with such and such agency, and this is basically what we are either selling or offering. A few times when we've had these requests, and often they come to mobile numbers. And let's face it, most people are not going to call personal mobile numbers who are truly seeking to sell something officially. It's usually going to go to a company account or a company landline. But every time we've heard clients talk about it, when they actually insist on having that correspondence come from a formal source, the call quickly ends. So the moral of the story is just don't don't feel ashamed, I guess, to ask for a formal approval, a confirmation that that source or that particular person is of the authority that they claim to be. And this also, by the way, applies to personal visits, because we hear this a lot for businesses. Somebody who claims to be an official will come into a business, again, trying to sell something. Do not be afraid. And by the way, legally, you have full right, as long as they come into your space, for you to ask for their identification number. So don't let the appearances confuse you or mislead you or intimidate you in actually asking for the identification and for insisting to have some sort of a formal documentation to show that they actually have the authority to ask for what they're asking.
Okay, Ludmilla, and this topic this week came from an SMS we received saying just that, that this person had received unsolicited calls from an alleged government authority selling advertisement space in some publication, allegedly. They received a call the week before from someone claimed to be part of the civil defence, and that person said they would send information by WhatsApp. And when the person who SMS'd us in said, we said we needed to see an official email, he quickly ended the conversation. So they very much followed through with the advice that you've given there, which is get the person on email, get them to send through some official clarification and state who they are and get it in writing. On this segment, obviously, every week we ask you to send in your legal questions to us, and Lavinia is very kind in that she covers a range of topics for us, from property through to unsolicited calls, contracts, finance, things like that. And we've had our first SMS in today, and it is with regard to property. So Lavinia, I wonder if I can throw this one at you now. This person messages in, they say, hi, I own an apartment. The area mentioned in the title deed is 1835 square feet, but the actual area is less than that. There is an unused area outside the apartment. The unused area can be converted into a terrace. My question is can I negotiate that the extra area be given to me and make the apartment actually as per the title deed? So they're trying to turn that extra space outside into the kind of indoor space, if you like, through an extension to the apartment. They're trying to win back some of the space that they were supposed to get from their title deed. Can they do that?
Well, this is a multifaceted scenario, and I'll tell you for a number of reasons. One is, as the saying goes, the devil is in the details. And we've seen a lot of cases like this where the expectation of an investor is that the property will be of a certain size. And that's because on the document, on the SBA or on the booking form, let's say it said 1,000 square foot. Now, if you keep digging, and this is, again, the kind of there are different variations of this particular scenario, but the general rule, or a common scenario, is that if we actually keep reading through the contract, this 1,000 square foot, just for simplicity's sake, is actually not the net area, and so the gross area. Often, that's sort of the developer's excuse or response is, and in fact, what we're selling you is a gross area, not net. Now, gross can entail anything, and again, you need to keep drilling through the document, and often the gross area, if you actually read it, it includes parts of the elevator, parts of the parking, parts of the hallways and
common
such.
Common space,
yes. And from a legal perspective, whether that actually stands is it's a different discussion. But this is basically what the developers often rely on: is that contractually, in fact, you don't get 1,000 square feet; you get less because it's the gross square foot. So in this particular listener's question, what you expected and what the developer may claim that you signed up or agreed to per contract, there's obviously a discrepancy, and that contractually, or at least if you just read the agreement, they may perceivably be in the right. Now, so that's one element. So always go back to the contract, because that would always be your starting point. So if it's clearly says that it's gross, your leverage to negotiate, for example, to use this additional space that you identified as part of your square footage will be less. Now, let's say whether that's your scenario or your contract is very clear that you're actually getting net, and in fact you're getting gross. So obviously, then from a leverage standpoint, you have more of an argument. But then now, not all of the authority to negotiate may necessarily be in the hands of the developer. So it depends on what this extra space that you have identified, what it's part of. Because if it is part of the common area, it may actually not be in part of the authority of the developer to give that to you, because let's say the building is sold freehold to everybody else. It's now owned in common, and the developer may not necessarily have the legal right to it. That there's one nuance to that. The other one is the Dubai municipality, because a lot of this space has to also be approved by the Dubai municipality in terms of how you want to repurpose it. So there could be a lot more than just one entity involved in giving you the authority or approval to reuse that space. So it's difficult to answer that question with a more degree of specificity than that. But certainly, if your contract is fairly clear and you think that space is wasted otherwise, my advice always is to try to negotiate with a developer, whoever it is that has control over the building, that at least temporarily you might be able to benefit from the space.
Read the contract thoroughly and go back and try to negotiate. Good advice there, NLT.
Yes, indeed, absolutely. Drive Live Talks Legal continues.
Drive Live Talks Legal.
We are talking legal on Drive Live today. Our guest, Ludmila Yamalova from Yamalova and Plethka. And we're going to head straight to the phones, Ludmila. We have Pankaj on line number one. And Pankaj is having some trouble with tenants. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, Pankaj. Do you want to let Ludmila know what's happening with your tenants, please?
I have a property in the TCOM C area, which is an office in an office building. And I rented it out to a local businessman 3 years ago. And I checked him out. He had 3-4 good businesses. He had a good reputation. We agreed to a rent and he paid up and everything was fine. First year went by nicely. In the second year, halfway, they said, look, we have taken up a partnership with somebody, so we would like to change the name on the contract. Would you mind? Because we are getting into a new business name. So I said, I have no issues. And the checks were still there with me from the first party, and we changed the name. This year, before the rent contract was to expire in the middle of May, I checked with them, and I was told, look, deal with the partner who's in Australia and he will let you know what's happening. So I got in touch with him by WhatsApp and email, and I was told, yes, we are going to renew the contract, no issues. When the time came for the checks to be delivered to me and to sign the contract, the gentleman is still in Australia. He has not given me the money. It's 2.5 months now. He promises to send the money every week with WhatsApp, but I don't know what to do. He doesn't seem to be sent. Then finally, after much pressure and persuasion, he sent me a check, a personal check from Australia by courier, which said so many dirhams and so many cents, not fils. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the local bank has bounced the check. Now, I don't know this guy. I don't have his ID or passport copy. I don't have his address. I don't know what to do.
Okay. So, Ludmila, obviously when it's in a different jurisdiction, there are different issues at stake here too.
Yes. Well, there's a few issues going on. And one, just for clarification purposes, Pankaj, you said you were requested on the second year to update the lease agreement to reflect the new structure, the new partnership. Currently, the party to the lease agreement is this gentleman in Australia or the same tenant you had first year in the lease agreement?
The tenancy is the name of the new company.
Okay.
The tenancy was always in the name of the company. So there was a particular real estate company in whose name the first two agreements were signed. And after a little while, after the second year lease started, it was changed to a different company saying, look, I've got into partnership with somebody and this is what we are going to call the company now. So I said, I have no problem. And I changed it. Okay.
Right. So just as a way, I guess, sort of as more of a comment, and at this point, for your purposes, it may be a little too late. But when you do something like that, it's very important that you get all the corporate documents to substantiate who the new party to the agreement is. So in other words, all the corporate documents of who the new company is, where it's incorporated, and who's behind that company, including who the manager is, and obviously their passport copies. Because as you said right now, the gentleman you are dealing with who is allegedly in Australia, you don't have any relationship with that person. Well, that shouldn't have been
Ludmila,
the case.
Yeah. Ludmila, when I changed the name, the person who was managing the company was still the same person who had signed the contract. So there were no other changes except the name of the company. Now, they did not inform me that from this year onwards, this partner moved and the other one is going to take over the whole management.
Sure. So I understand, and I appreciate the position you were in, and it's basically because you trusted them, so you didn't necessarily maybe ask all the relevant questions and all the required documents. But what should have happened is that you should have gotten copies of all the new corporate entity, and you would have confirmed through that who the manager of that company is, one, and who the shareholders or the decision makers of that particular company are, because just because you're dealing with a particular person that sort of that dealt with you under the previous contract does not necessarily mean that that person is actually an official representative of the new company, of the new partner. But then in any event, be it as it may, so it looks like you may be missing some of the documents in terms of even identifying who the party to the agreement is, and then B, who are the people behind that party, because as long as you're dealing with a corporation, it's obviously just a name, and then some of the other relevant people that you need to have contact details of whom you need to have contact details are the manager on the company, directors of the company, and the shareholders of the company, and so on and so forth. And those documents and that kind of information would normally be available from the memorandum associations, articles and corporations, sort of corporate founding documents, which sounds like you might be missing. And because of that, you don't even really know who has the official capacity right now to represent the company. Now, I'll tell you why it may be an issue in terms of what your options are moving forward. So let's just kind of park the issue of the identity of the party. Now, legally speaking, what happens when when your tenant failed to pay your rent? This is in legal terms, it's considered to be breach of contract. So you had a contract where you provide property, they pay for that property. Now you haven't been paid for the last 2.5 months, so there is a breach of contract. So there is a default. Under the UAE law, and the Dubai law that deals with rental properties, you have the right to ultimately ask for eviction of that particular person or that particular party, but you first need to give them 30-day notice, and it has to be an official notice, and it's 30-day notice for them to fix their default. And if they don't, then at that point you can start proceedings to evict them and obviously seek compensation. So what you would do here is the first, since you have ultimately not been paid, you know, even this check from Australia, I mean, you can slice and dice it however you want, but the reality is such that you have not been paid for the last 2.5 months. So there is already sufficient grounds for default. So you should go to the notary and issue that party a notice for default and give them 30 days to...
The notice, issued that notice already.
Okay, you've issued the notice. And after the expiration of the 30-day notice, then now you can start proceedings with the land department and with the rent committee, the RDC. And it's very important that in your claim, you ask for two things. One, you ask for compensation for all the months that where you have not been paid rent and where you will not have gotten paid rent, because obviously this is going to go on for a few more months. And so all these months, you're not going to get compensated. And two, very importantly, is that you also ask, in addition to that, that the party vacates the property. Because often, if you don't ask for vacation, you may get a judgment for money, but you will not be able to evict them. And until you have that final judgment, you actually, but you're stuck with them. You can't physically evict them unless they amicably decide to move out. This is where the identity of the party is important, because in terms of serving the notice, and once you go to RDC, that will have to be, the court will have to file an official notice on the party stating or notifying them that the case has been filed against them. This is where now you need to have the address of the party and you need to have contact details of the people that represent the company. So it may be that you'll spend a few months trying to just serve this party with the court proceedings until...
Their only address that I know is my office.
Exactly. Exactly. So what happens in courts in cases like this, the court bailiff will come and will try to serve. And so at some point, they might either stick a notice on the door and consider that to be sufficient service of process. And in other times, because obviously you're disputing the very same premises that where they're being served, it may be that the court will prefer that you actually put a notice in by publication. So, but generally speaking, courts are conservative in allowing the publication notice to be issued by publication too soon in the process. So it may be that you have to attend a few hearings before the court will say, fine, now you can publish this in the newspaper. And at that point, once the party has been served, then you can plead your case. Now, so unfortunately, you'll have to wait until you have a final judgment before you're able to then move for enforcement. And as part of the enforcement, you'll have to call the police and have them enter the premises along with the court bailiff and you, and you basically seize the property unless they pay you, obviously, the judgment before then. So as you can tell, it's frustrating because you're not getting paid, and now you have to spend more money and time and effort trying to get rid of these people so that you can actually benefit from the office. So therefore, it's not cheap, and it's not cheap in the way that you don't need to hire a lawyer. You can do all this on your own, but it's not cheap in the way that you're losing rent in the meantime, and you still need to spend money to litigate this. So therefore, if you can agree with them amicably for them just to move out, honestly, at this point in time, if they move out next month, it'll be economically probably a better deal for you than actually pursuing them in court for unpaid rent and for vacating the property. So try to evict them, because somebody like this, based on my experience, they have already proven to not be a reliable tenant. So you probably don't want to negotiate any future relationship with them. So if you can amicably get rid of them, then that would be my preferred strategy for you. If not, then you have to brace yourself and get ready to go through RDC.
Pankaj, we hope that has helped you a little bit today. Good best of luck with your proceedings with RDC. And thank you for calling in. We now cross to another line. We've got Artie waiting on the line. She's been contacted about a property she rented 6 years ago. So Artie, please do you mind just briefly explaining to Ludmilla what the issue seems to be? And then after the break, we'll come back to you with your answer.
Hi,
Artie. Hi. Would you please mind explaining to Ludmilla what the legal issue here is with regarding to the property you rented 6 years ago?
So it wasn't 6 years ago, it was about 9 years ago that we rented this property from a large real estate company. So, and we stayed there for 3 years and then vacated it. Now we are staying for 6 years in some other property. All of a sudden, this year, we started getting an email and now calls that we need to pay them around 4,000 something in some arrears and parking charges and some maintenance charges. So this person who calls, We told them to send us a legal notice or a legal this thing. He says, no, I'm not going to send you anything. I'm going to keep troubling you, calling you. He started calling my office now on the landline of my office and kind of harassing us. So I just wanted to know what is our recourse in this.
Very interesting case. So there's two angles. One is their legal standing in terms of having expectation, I guess, legal right and expectation of receiving these so-called payments in arrears that you allegedly owe to them. That's one. And two is their tactic in which they're proceeding and trying to get you to pay. So with regards to the legal right, I'm not sure of the statute of limitation here, because it sounds like this might even be a question of statute of limitation, since it's already been at least, from what I can tell, 6 years since you moved out.
Yes.
So they may not even be procedurally, may have a claim against you. But be it as it may, let's say even if there is no statute of limitation barring their claim, you have identified correctly. So have them proceed on legal basis, which is the only way for them to claim payment from you, is just to serve not just a legal notice, but ultimately to go through court, because it is in court that they will have to show that, for example, they had a contractual relationship with you on the basis of which they can now claim that you allegedly owed them something and didn't pay. Because without that, on what basis are they claiming, and what are they claiming? So for them, they do need to go to court, and they need to substantiate and show to court that they had some sort of a legal basis upon which they're now demanding this payment. I tell you, for a number of reasons based on what you just said, but also the amount of which they're claiming, it's highly unlikely that they will actually bring a court case. So it sounds like it's more of a bullying tactic. They will not file a court case. So therefore, you are absolutely right, and I encourage you to continue to stay the course in terms of just maintaining that they've filed an official claim. So that's
sure, but now it's disturbing my office.
Sure,
this thing, because they're calling me on a daily basis. I blocked their number on my phone, but now they've started calling on the office you know, the main line.
Right.
And so it's really embarrassing for me. He tells people that she hasn't paid and she needs to pay us and all of that. I mean,
correct. And this is why I said that I compartmentalized the two issues. So I think legally, you're pretty safe. Now, with regards to this, so the harassment tactics that they're deploying, that's where you can actually file a criminal case against them. So what they're doing right now is they are, first of all, defaming you by calling the office and breaching and then claiming something that, even if it were right, but it may perhaps be shameful or embarrassing, and therefore they have no right. Legally, you're protected in this country from that kind of embarrassment. So you can actually file a criminal case against them for harassing you, for breaching your privacy by calling your office and by embarrassing you or defaming you. And the UAE takes these kind of claims quite seriously because the right to privacy and reputation are quite strictly guarded. So for you to do that, what I recommend is that you go to the police and you just print out all these, your bank, your phone statements and your WhatsApp messages or SMS messages, because the police will be able to trace the phone number from which the calls come, and you explain that this is you're just being harassed for no legal right, because legally they're not allowed to do it. You see, if there is a legal claim, then there is a legal route by which they should pursue this claim, and it's not doing this way, it's going through the court. So therefore here, what you have right now is a criminal case. So I'd recommend first you tell them that, and you tell them that you're recording all the calls and you report to the police, and maybe that will make them go away. If that doesn't happen, then I encourage you that you go to the police and file this as a criminal case, and you should not have a problem doing so.
Artie, best of luck with that. You've got a couple of avenues to pursue. We'll be coming back to more of your questions for Ludmilla after the break, so do keep texting them into us on 4001 and we'll get round to them as soon as we can.
This is Drive Live. Get in touch with the show.
Text us on 4001.
This is Drive Live, and we're joined live in the studio for Drive Live Talks Legal by Ludmilla Yamalova. She's the founder and managing partner at HPL Yamalova and Plefka, and she's been answering your questions this hour. And Ludmilla, we actually have somebody on the line now. Sabiha joins us. She sent us a message regarding an investment her and her husband were trying to make, and we asked her to get on the line with us just to explain it in a little more detail. So hello, Sabiha. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm going to put you on with Ludmilla now. If you could just give us a bit of an explanation about your issue.
Sure. So what's happened here is my husband had invested in a business with his friends, and he was more like a silent partner where he would just do the investment. The business did not go in really well, and it required more investment. So we decided to pull out of the business, and we transferred all the shares in his friend's name, who is the owner of the business. Now, his friend was not able to maintain the business again, and he could not update the trade license. So all the documents, we've got the share transfer certificate and everything done, but he is not able to update the trade license. Now the challenge is, we had taken a couple of business loans when I was one of the members or one of the shareholders of the company, and we've spoken to the bank and we've told them the whole situation, but the bank will not update their records because the trade license is not updated. And now we are in a kind of stuck because he's left the country and he's gone. And we have situations with bank calling us, loans not paid, and we're just finding it so difficult. We don't know what to do.
Let me just clarify one thing. So when you're talking about the trade license not updated, you mean right now the company is still in the name of the previous partner and neither you nor your husband is listed or registered with the company officially, correct?
We officially not listed because we have a share transfer certificate done through the court. But he was supposed to go and update the trade license. It was up for renewal. But he's not done that because he doesn't have the money to do so.
Okay. And then you want to ultimately have the shares transferred over to you or the company transferred to you?
We don't have anything with it. We've transferred everything to him. We just don't want this headache anymore because we've lost so much of money. And now we're losing sleep over it. And we don't know what to do.
And this is why I ask these questions, because what you seem to suggest is that you would, if you had the ability to have the shares transferred back to you or your husband, that you would want to pursue that route. And I would caution you against it, because it sounds like your husband, while he was investing in the business, he wasn't really involved in the business. And therefore, you really don't know the state of the business, from what I can tell. And so what you might inadvertently do is that you might put yourselves into as owners of the business, as responsible for the business, and while not really knowing the state of the business. So you may actually, by virtue of becoming owners or having the shares transferred in your name, you might actually become liable for more liabilities than you are right now. So that's with regards to the company.
Sorry, I think I confused you here. We've already transferred the shares and we don't want them back. Like, the money's lost and we're fine with it. We just want to get out of this whole mess. Like, the bank's chasing us and saying that the business or whatever the details they have is in my name. But then we're trying to tell them that we've got the share certificate, we've got the transfer details, everything we have. But the person over here is not there anymore. He's actually left the country. So I don't know what's the next steps for us to resolve this without complicating it any more for us.
Sure. Well, the thing is, if I understand you correctly, so you're saying the company is now in your name. And if the company is in your name, then, well, the only thing you can do right now is close it down. And unfortunately, as part of the closing down, you're actually going to have to go through what's called the liquidation process, and then where you'll have to disclose who all the creditors are. And if there are other banks and other lenders that have liabilities or to whom the company owes liabilities, then you will have to figure out how to square them away. And that's if I understand you correctly, and you are now actually officially part of the company. If you're not, if you just have these share certificates, but the records have not been updated and you're not officially part of the company, that's good news for you, because at least in that way, you're not responsible for any other liabilities that might be attached to the company, not you as individuals, but to the company. Now, with regards to the loans with the bank, and if you took those in your personal capacity, then unfortunately, that's just between you and the banks, and you will have to you'll have to negotiate some kind of a repayment plan, and unless they want to settle with you and offer or accept a smaller payment or a deferral of the payment, and there isn't really much you can do. It's, you know, it's basically you took a loan, you took money from the bank, and now you have to kind of pay it off. It's just really between, I'd say, compartmentalize all your liabilities and try to approach the various creditors one by one to try to settle the amounts that you're owed, you know, ideally, obviously, at least reduce the payments. But just, you know, if you can, if you have some assets, let's say company assets that you think you can liquidate and settle the loans with those assets, then that's good news. I mean, you could do that, but that doesn't sound to be the case. So I think, unfortunately, you're stuck with the obligations which you undertook, and your best bet is just to try to negotiate with the creditors to see if they'll provide you some sort of a grace period.
Okay, Sabiha, hopefully Ludmilla's advice will help you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for calling Drive Live. That's all we've got time for on Drive Live Talks Legal for this week. Apologies to any questions we didn't get to. If you keep them ready, we'll get to them next week. Ludmilla Yamalova from Yamalova & Plethka, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.